You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 4th of December 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Louise Beale. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, as Turkey asks NATO for a defence system to protect their border with Syria, we'll be asking how it could affect the conflict and we'll consider how dangerous the threat of chemical weapons actually is.
As we have already made clear, any deployment would be defensive only. It would in no way support a no-fly zone or any offensive operation.
Spiraling production costs, weak prices and wildcat strikes. There's trouble in South Africa's mining industry. We'll see what the departure of Anglo-American CEO means for the sector. Plus, we'll see what luxury travel trends to keep an eye on in the year ahead.
I think the hot ticket for next year is going to be in Asia, and I think it's going to be Myanmar. And we see that as an opportunity to bring the luxury cruise product to a new rising destination.
Lots still to come in the next hour here on Midori House, so stay tuned. But first, let's catch up on all the latest news with Bill Bingham.
Monocle 24 News. NATO Secretary General Anders Rasmussen has given his support to US President Barack Obama's warning to the Syrian government not to use chemical weapons against its own people. He says such a move would prompt an immediate international response. Syria denies it plans to use chemical weapons against anti-Assad rebels. Mr. Rasmussen says the deployment of Patriot missiles in Turkey will serve as a deterrent for Syria, but Russia has warned against the militarization of the conflict. Britain's Foreign Secretary, William Hague, says concern about the Syrian government's intentions is growing.
We are worried about Syria's chemical weapons. We've long been worried about those weapons. And of course, for a long time, Syria has denied having chemical or biological weapons. It's very obvious they do have those weapons. We are concerned about them. We've become more concerned about them in recent days for the same reason that the United States has.
Police have used tear gas against protesters who've gathered near the presidential palace in Egypt's capital, Cairo. It's been reported some of the protesters cut through barbed wire surrounding the palace. They're protesting against recent decisions taken by President Mohamed Morsi, in particular the rushed drafting of a new constitution to be voted on in 2 weeks' time. Demonstrators are also said to have gathered in large numbers in Alexandria. At least three crew members are reported to have been saved after their cargo ship sank in the Black Sea near Turkey, but nine remain missing. 11 Ukrainians and one Russian were on board the Volga Bult 199 when it went down in stormy seas off the town of Sile in Istanbul province. Unconfirmed reports say one person has died. The Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, is warning extreme weather could become routine. Speaking at the UN climate change talks in Doha, he says the new norm poses an existential threat to the human race. A thaw of Arctic sea ice reached a record low this year. Superstorms and rising sea levels were all signs of crisis, he said. Mr. Ban was addressing almost 200 nations at the talks on finding ways to slow rising greenhouse gas emissions. He says the danger signs are all around.
One third of the world's population lives in countries with moderate to high water stress. Land degradation affects 1.5 billion people. Ice caps are showing unprecedented melting, permafrost is thawing, sea levels are rising. The abnormal is the now new normal.
Dutch prosecutors say they're charging three teenagers with manslaughter for allegedly taking part in an attack on a linesman over a youth football match. Volunteer linesman Richard Neuwenhuizen died in hospital on Monday, a day after he was beaten and kicked by players from Amsterdam team Neue Slotten in Almere. Mr. Neuwenhuizen's own son had been playing in the game. Hundreds of people in the Sri Lankan capital Colombo have staged a peaceful rally in support of the country's Chief Justice, who faces impeachment charges. Shirani Bandara Nayake has appeared before a parliamentary committee for a second time to answer the charges. Police say around 600 lawyers, judges and civil society activists, including Buddhist and Christian priests, gathered outside the Supreme Court building to show their support. At least 18 members of the Eritrean soccer squad have disappeared in Uganda while playing in a regional tournament. It's thought they may be planning to seek asylum. United Nations Human Rights Chief Navi Pillay has accused Eritrea's government of carrying out summary executions, torture, and detaining thousands of political prisoners. That's the latest news here on Monocle 24.
Bill, thank you very much. It is 5 minutes past the hour and you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Op London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando,
London.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One in London. Since the Syrian uprising against President Assad began in March last year, the situation in the country continues to deteriorate on a daily basis. The latest development comes as Syria's neighbour, Turkey, has requested a Patriot missile defence shield to protect it against a chemical weapons attack from Syria. It comes after Israeli intelligence claims Syria had chemical weapons and were moving them, perhaps in preparation to use them. NATO foreign ministers are currently meeting in Brussels and are set to approve Turkey's request, but they've also joined Barack Obama in warning Syria that using chemical weapons against its own people would be completely unacceptable. Well, joining me now to discuss all this is Fadi Hakoura, Associate Fellow for the Europe Programme at Chatham House. Thank you very much for joining me. Can I first off start by asking you about this Patriot system? Exactly what is it and what does it require? Does it need troops as well? And sort of tell us more about it and how it works.
The Patriot system is a surface-to-air missile that targets primarily incoming missiles, but also aircraft. It has a 50 to 60 kilometer radius. It's a very effective system that the United States and NATO have used to neutralize missile threats in the past, including in the first Gulf War of 1990-1991.
And so why have they asked for it again? What are their main reasons for wanting this system?
I think that there are a number of reasons. One is that Turkey is fearful that President Assad may be tempted to use the chemical weapons against his neighbors, including Turkey. That's because Turkey is trying to mobilize international efforts to overthrow the Assad regime, as well as the fact that there is an American air base in southern Turkey, not too far from the Syrian border. The second reason is that the Turkish government wants to be seen as doing something against the Assad regime. And third, the Turkish government has been very, very much frustrated at what they consider as the reticence from Europe and the United States in not getting militarily involved in Syria to hasten the demise of the Assad regime.
That's sort of, excuse me, one of the main points, isn't it, really, that they are frustrated by perhaps a lack of action. Do you think, therefore, that the request for this Patriot system is partly because they want the protection, but also because they're trying to get the situation moving?
I think that they want to try to drag NATO, in particular the United States and Europe, into the Syrian conflict. They want the West really to have a more forceful stand against the Assad regime, because Turkey has largely miscalculated at the resilience and the longevity and durability of the Assad regime.
And would this system, would it be sufficient to help with a no-fly zone, or does it not go that far?
I think that such a system can be helpful to enforce a no-fly zone over Syrian airspace. However, it is not sufficient in itself, simply because it has a limited radius of 50 to 60 kilometers, so it can probably enforce a no-fly zone over northern Syria at most. Secondly, you have the Syrian-Turkish border is a 900-kilometer border, and there are insufficient number of Patriot missiles to cover the entire border. And thirdly, the Patriot system is a surface-to-air missile designed to intercept missiles rather than aircraft. So it's not really; it's more of a defensive is more of a defensive mechanism than an offensive mechanism to enforce a no-fly zone.
And does it require troops to be there to operate it? Are we going to see NATO troops moving to the border, or is that not necessary?
It's not necessary. What are needed are NATO engineers, particularly from Germany and the Netherlands, where these who will be supplying Turkey with these sophisticated what they call PAC-3 Patriot missile system. So you'll have engineers rather than soldiers. If they need to, the Turkish military will protect them against any possible strikes from Syria.
Now, NATO foreign ministers are currently in Brussels, as I mentioned earlier. They do seem set to approve this Patriot system. How do you think that's going to affect the balance of what's going on in Syria in terms of, well, how it's going to affect Turkey, but just generally in terms of the balance of the conflict?
In the immediate, I do not think that it will affect the conflict taking place between the Assad regime and the armed opposition. It will not affect the balance of power. What it will do, and what it's already doing, is causing enormous amount of consternation in Tehran and in Moscow, because they do not want to see NATO dragged into this conflict. They do not want to see NATO get militarily involved in Syria, and therefore have viewed this missiles deployment or potential deployment as a strategic threat rather than a benign defensive posture.
So do you think we are any closer to any form of, well, heavier intervention?
I do not think that the United States nor Europe want to get militarily involved in Syria after the conflict in Afghanistan, in Iraq. There is not that appetite for intervention. At the same time, also public opinion in Europe and the United States are not keen for any new military adventures. And now the key concern is the economy rather than foreign conflicts.
And just briefly, obviously, we've seen a lot of leaders talking about the chemical weapons threat. Barack Obama saying that, you know, Syria must not use chemical weapons against its own people. That would be completely unacceptable. He says that they'll have to face the music, essentially, if they do. But he hasn't exactly said how. How worried are Turkey about the chemical weapons threat? And do we think it is actually a real one?
I think it is definitely a real one. Syria does possess some sizable amounts of chemical weapons, such as sarin gas. Israel is worried. Even Russia, Assad's staunchest ally, is very much worried about these chemical weapons. And in fact, according to media reports, has engineers, specialists situated in Syria itself that could be deployed in the event that those weapons may be used.
Okay, Fadi Hakoura of Chatham House, thank you very much as ever for coming on the show. We'll be back in a moment to hear about the change at the top of South Africa's biggest company.
If you've ever wondered how the shirt on your back came into being, or the roof over your head, the chair you sit on, the laptop you tap on, the office you work in, the train, plane, car, boat, bicycle and lift that transport you, the phone you talk on, or even the bath that you soak in. If you want to know about the things that you live with, then tune into Section D, Monocle 24's weekly dip into the world of design. Premiering each Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, we hop from front row to back street, workshop to fairground, taking in the latest in the worlds of architecture, fashion, retail, transport, technology and graphics. If you want to know how design impacts your daily life and who the people are dedicated to making life better, then pull up a pew and tune in.
That That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Revolutions are fertile conditions for filmmakers, so Monocle took a front row seat at the Doha Tribeca Film Festival to witness the cinema of change emerging in the Arab region.
Like anywhere, when there's social change, people want to raise their voices and want to share what they've been through or what they've experienced. And what I like, it's they do it in a very intimate way. And that's what we want to acknowledge as well, because I think it's stronger and smarter on the long run.
Spotlight on celluloid dreams in the Arab world, premiering on monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House. Cynthia Carroll's appointment in 2006 was designed to deliver a jolt to the mining industry. A foreign woman whose mission was to both streamline Anglo-Americans' operations to focus solely on seven commodities and apparently fight the chauvinism of sector leaders past and present. Fast forward 6 years and her departure in a climate where South Africa's mining industry is beset by strikes, spiralling production costs and poor price outlooks leaves the nation's biggest company at a critical juncture. To find out if Anglo-Americans' problems are indicative of the market in South Africa, we're joined on the line now by Ron Darby, markets editor for South Africa's Business Day. Thank you very much for joining us, Ron. First of all, just to talk about Cynthia Carroll's departure, I mean, how significant is it that she's leaving?
It's very significant. I'm sure the whole point people were saying was to internationalize Anglo-American and take it away from South Africa, but to diversify it away. And 6 years come, 6 years later, Anglo-American is still a company that's very much based in South Africa. Most of its revenue still comes from South Africa. So she hasn't managed to break away from Anglo-American South African heritage as it was.
So Anglo-American, as we're saying, you know, having a number of problems, is it the political climate in South Africa that's really affecting the company, or is it factors such as platinum prices, for example, that are playing more of a part?
It would be platinum prices. You know, then like in 2008, Anglo-American platinum provided about 30% of Anglo's operating profits. And since then, since the platinum price has fell off the cliff, as it were, because of oversupply problems, platinum has come to be one of its biggest nightmares. And the fact is, the prices have been coming down, but the cost of mining has kept on rising. We have Eskom increasing prices far above inflation. We have mining labor ructions in the country, with settlements also high above in the high teens. So the combination of these factors have made platinum, where they have over 40,000 odd workers, almost untenable at the moment with the platinum price where it is at present.
Exactly, because as you said, it used to make up 30% of total revenues for the company. As you alluded to there, it's going to be impossible to keep going with the workforce as they have it. So are we looking at job cuts as being, you know, inevitable?
It is inevitable. The thing is, Anglo-American Platinum is the world's biggest supplier of platinum. And in a sense, they have control of the price of platinum. But being with the strength of unions in South Africa, it's very difficult for Anglo-American to cut costs, to shut production, which in turn would mean less jobs. So this is going to have to happen. There's a review currently underway over its platinum interest, which comes out in next year, probably February. We will see some of its shafts being shut, some the more unprofitable ones, and spinning off some other joint ventures to black investors within the country. So if they get platinum right within South Africa, given the difficult labor relations, given the high cost, then Anglo-American is in a much better position than it is right now.
So that really is, you know, is a possibility of carving the business up, basically, to save it?
Yeah, it has to. As it is, it's just too big right now, Anglo-American, especially in terms of staff costs, too. With the platinum price where it is and the outlook, is given that the global economy doesn't look like it's going to be an immediate bounce back next year, it's going to have to do some carving up of its operations locally.
And also, as you mentioned there, the global economy, I mean, a number of rating agencies have raised concerns about the company's reliance on South Africa. Investors are keen for a change. So that is presumably driving this as well.
It is. It's, since the Marikana tragedy in August, there's been this huge spotlight on South African mining and the inherent problems within the country. And it's made investors in London and New York very nervy about being too exposed, overly exposed to the country. Whereas gold miners have a situation where our gold production peaked in 1970 and generally it's been coming much more deeper. This is over beyond the country's domestic issues. It's just become much more unviable to keep on mining gold. So they're looking at really getting out of the country. Anglo Platinum is in a different, Anglo American is different position because of this platinum operation.
Okay, Ron Darby, Markets Editor for South Africa's Business Day. Thank you very much for joining me. You're listening to Midori House with me, Louise Beale. Angela Merkel will be launching her bid for a third term as German Chancellor at today's annual Congress of her Christian Democratic Union Party. Despite turbulent times across the continent, Merkel continues to enjoy a level of popularity at home unprecedented in post-war Germany. So what should we expect from the conference, and will Merkel's enduring electoral appeal help her party to reverse some of the trends we saw in last year's state votes? Well, to explore those questions and more, Quentin Peel, the Berlin bureau chief of the Financial Times, spoke to Monocle's Tom Edwards.
Quentin, thank you very much for joining us as always. I guess the first thing to ask, what is the atmosphere like in Hanover this year?
Oh, pretty good. This is a party that feels that it's actually picking up in the polls and is going to come out on top. They're meeting in Hanover because they've got a state election here in January, and it's very close. The local party leader, David McAllister, the half-Scottish minister-president of Lower Saxony, is a popular figure, and he got a very good reception from the audience here. But they know it's going to be tough, and they know that the key to the success of the CDU is Angela Merkel. She is the most popular person they've got, and she's still very popular with the German electorate.
I wanted to ask you more about that. Just in terms of that broad trend electorally, how surprising is it to a seasoned watcher of the scene such as yourself that she just seems to be able to keep going and do no wrong in the eyes of her adoring public?
I think that Europe is a very important part of this. They like the way she's dealing with the Eurozone crisis. They like her insistence that this is a long, hard slog. They think that she is defending German interests. But at the end of the day, she is being a good European, and that combination plays very well to the German electorate. So I think that actually is probably her trump card in these elections, not so much what they're going on about here at the party conference, which is much more social policy and economic policy. It's her competence. She's a good chancellor, and that's how the voters see her.
It's very interesting, Quentin, as watching this from the UK, where obviously selling austerity measures and European responsibility is, as everyone probably imagines, a much more of a difficult balancing act to do. I just wonder why is it that then the German people seem to engage with that idea of being a good European so much more readily, even when the European crisis seems to affect them at home as well?
The truth is that the European vision, if you like, in Germany has been a very central vision to this country, really, ever since the Second World War. It's binding Germany in and making Germany acceptable to the world as a good European. And I think that's the button that Merkel presses, and it goes down very well. The other one is, of course, that it's very deep in the German psyche that you should live within your means, that you shouldn't borrow as if there's no tomorrow, that you should actually think about your children and your grandchildren, those were Merkel's words here today, in keeping their spending under control. So that message actually goes down very well with the German electorate. You've got to add the one other thing, which is, of course, that Germany has not suffered as badly in this crisis, really, as any other European country. The economy has actually kept going pretty well. Unemployment is at the lowest level it's been for 20 years. And that actually cheers people up. They don't realize quite how bad the crisis is in other parts of the European Union, or if they realize, it's a long way away.
And in terms then of the objectives of this actual conference, is it one of these rather rare instances then where a relatively low-key, a relatively almost headline-free event is actually what the CDU would prefer? They'll just trust to Merkel to manage their broader long-term prospects, and they just want this conference to largely go without a hitch. They're not worried about making a lot of press.
I think that's it. I think we're seeing here the coronation of Queen Angela. She's got a longer standing ovation than she's ever had. It ran to nearly 8 minutes. They were struggling a bit by the end of it, but nonetheless they were determined to show that they loved her. And she's going to get re-elected as party leader with probably a 95% vote in favour. So it's really just saying Merkel is our magic weapon. But there's a very important thing behind that. They love her as Chancellor, but I don't think the party faithful are quite as enthusiastic about her as party leader. There's something about Angela Merkel. She was a latecomer to politics. She didn't grow up in the party. She came from East Germany, and she doesn't really understand the grassroots of the party. She keeps trying to press the right buttons, but it's a sort of, they respect her, but they don't love her. They know she's their secret weapon, but having said that, she's not really one of them. So there's a very curious, if you like, divided loyalty there. And I think that the moment that Angela Merkel no longer delivers power to them, if she actually loses an election, they might get rid of her as party leader very quickly.
Quentin Peel there, the Berlin bureau chief of the Financial Times, speaking to Monocle's Tom Edwards. In a moment, we'll have the news at the bottom of the hour. But first, here's some music. This is Tennis with Petition. That was Tennis with Petition. In the next half hour of the programme, we explore the hatchet jobs literary critics are fanatic about in 2012, decide whether Hispanic consumer power can save the American retail economy, and we take a trip to Cannes to find out what the notable developments from the international luxury travel market.
I think the hot ticket for next year is going to be in Asia, and I think it's going to be Myanmar. And we see that as an opportunity to bring the luxury cruise product to a new rising destination.
But first, let's have the news headlines from Bill Bingham.
NATO Secretary General Anders Rasmussen has backed US President Barack Obama's warning to the Syrian government not to use chemical weapons against its own people. He says such a move would prompt an immediate international response. The Syrian government denies it plans to use chemical weapons against anti-Assad rebels. Mr. Rasmussen says the deployment of Patriot missiles in Turkey will serve as a deterrent for Syria, but Russia has warned against the militarization of the conflict. Police have used tear gas against protesters who've gathered near the presidential palace in Egypt's capital, Cairo. It's being reported some of the protesters cut through barbed wire surrounding the palace. They're protesting against recent decisions taken by President Mohamed Morsi, in particular the rushed drafting of a new constitution to be voted on in 2 weeks' time. At least three crew members are reported to have been saved after their cargo ship sank in the Black Sea near Turkey, but nine remain missing. 11 Ukrainians and one Russian were on board the Volga-Balt 199 when it went down in stormy seas off the town of Sile in Istanbul province. Secretary General of the United Nations Ban Ki-moon is warning extreme weather could become routine. Speaking at the UN climate change talks in Doha, he says the new norm poses an existential threat to the human race. Dutch protesters say they're charging three teenagers with manslaughter for allegedly taking part in an attack on a linesman over a youth football match. Volunteer linesman Richard Neuwenhuizen died in hospital on Monday, a day after he was beaten and kicked by players from an Amsterdam team. At least 80 members of the Eritrean soccer squad have disappeared in Uganda while playing in a regional tournament. It's thought they may be planning to seek asylum. United Nations Human Rights Chief Navi Pillay has accused Eritrea's government of carrying out summary executions, torture, and detaining thousands of political prisoners. Those are the latest headlines here on Monocle 24.
This is Midori House on Monocle 24, and we're coming to you live from London. Widely regarded as the ethnic group that won it for the newly elected President Obama, the Hispanic quarter of American society may now be touted as one of the answers to prop up the frail American retail sector. The fastest growing demographic group, their economic weight, has moved up the ladder from over $200 billion in 1990 to an estimated $1.5 trillion in 2015. Unsurprisingly, fashion brands and stores alike are chucking investment into capitalising on the trend. Well, Monocle's Barrett Austin joins me now on the line from New York to talk about this and just to see just how powerful this growing corner of the American population will be. Good afternoon to you, Barrett.
Good afternoon, Louise.
Well, there does seem to be this shifting focus among retailers to America's Hispanic population, particularly women. Is that right? What can you tell us about it?
It is, and as you mentioned, all of this is a bit unsurprising, given that Hispanics are far and away the fastest growing demographic group in the country. If you look at the numbers, buying power has grown tremendously amongst Hispanics in this country over the past couple of decades. If you look back to 1990, Hispanic Americans were spending around $200 billion a year. Today, the number is closer to $1.2 trillion, meaning that over the past 20 years, Hispanic consumers, their spending represents six times more sort of dollars going into the American economy year over year than it did, you know, back just 20 years ago. And the number is likely to continue to keep growing just because the demographic trends are likely to sort of stay on the same course.
So it's pretty, you know, accelerated growth. How is it actually translating? What are we seeing insofar as buying habits? What's driving the Hispanic consumer?
Well, it's still very much a largely emergent buying class. So price, value, that's sort of at the top of the equation. But that being said, if you look at what a lot of retailers are doing, there seems to be a growing sense of brand recognition, a sense that, you know, buyers are looking for things that are a bit more trend driven. So it's not simply a matter of, you know, what's affordable is what sells, but you find a lot of retailers, particularly those on the lower to sort of middle end, that are doing their part to really court Hispanic women shoppers in particular. And that ranges everything from, you know, marketing devoted specifically towards young Hispanic women, but also full-scale collections that are being developed for this end of the market.
And who precisely is getting in on the action? Which kind of retailers are going for this?
Well, as I said, it's primarily on this sort of mid to low end, but you're seeing everyone from, you know, a retailer like here in New York, you see someone like Macy's that's getting in on the action, but also a lot of retailers like Target, Kmart, which is in many ways sort of the retailing cousin to Walmart in this country. Kmart in particular has sort of led the charge. You're seeing a lot of collections that are specifically tailored to Hispanic buyers. There are a lot of sort of pop cultural icons, actresses, for instance, Selena Gomez, Sofia Vergara, who have partnered with Kmart to put out their own collections. And it's not simply a matter of doing a couple of shirts and a couple of dresses. It's everything from full-scale apparel, accessories, watches, even things like bedding and duvets that are inspired by these individuals. And the great thing about this is that these sort of cultural icons, the partnerships that they do with brands like Kmart, they appeal to young Hispanic buyers. But what we're seeing is the influence of these collections, it extends sort of far beyond the Hispanic group in particular. It's something that's appealing to all sort of young, culturally minded demographic groups.
Because I read as well that a survey found that 60% of Hispanic women are using apps on their smartphones to find the lowest price for goods. So you'd imagine that's probably in the younger sector. What about in the higher end sector? Are more luxury brands getting involved?
I think so. I think that Hispanic buyers are very much sort of in the foresight of luxury brands. But at the same time, you've had wealthy sort of Latins who've been doing lots of shopping around the world and representing somewhat of an important share of revenue for the luxury retailers. But it's not something that you're seeing really taking off at this point. There are retailers like Texas-based Neiman Marcus, who has recently partnered with Target, who's put out sort of a a less expensive couture-minded collection. So they're partnering with people like Carolina Herrera or Oscar de la Renta. So the good thing here is you see inevitably there will be some sort of demand from Hispanic buyers with collections like this. But at the same time, as I was saying before, these are collections that go far beyond just Hispanic consumers, and they'll appeal to buyers at large.
And as you mentioned, though, that this isn't sort of a phenomenon that's likely to tail off. It looks like it's going to grow.
I don't think so. I mean, if you look at the demographics, the number of Hispanics, both in terms of immigration and sort of expansion of families in this country, the numbers are likely to continue growing. If you look at statistics over the next 10, 20, 30, even 50 years, the number of Hispanics in America is scheduled to grow tremendously. So I think that moving forward, you'll see these retailers that I've just mentioned doing their bit to court buyers. But I think it's something that's likely to expand quite tremendously on the middle and on the high end market, because there's just so much potential for buying power sort of moving forward.
Indeed, so much potential. All right, Monocle's Barrett Austin from New York, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. The time is 18:38 here in London. For the savvy traveller, it's important to have an eye on the bargain and an ear to the ground for the upcoming gems on the geographic dartboard. And how better to stay clued up with the best that international travel can offer over the next year than to head to the International Luxury Travel Market. Held in Cannes and hearkening back to the values of good service and the personal touches of hoteliers, I caught up with Monocle contributing editor Alicia Kirby, who went down to find out what markets to keep an eye on.
Well, it's 11 years old and it's an invitation-only luxury travel fair. So they kind of cherry-pick, you know, the best of the industry with quite strict standards and gather them all together in kind of one place where they can all network together and meet luxury tour operators and meet people of the same kind.
So I was going to say a lot of networking must go on. Is it a long event and what kind of size is it? Are there lots of people there?
There are lots of people here. It's kind of set over three floors and I would say, I can't kind of pick a complete number, but I would say there are over 100 brands at least. You know, the luxury factor is probably illustrated by the amount of champagne going around on stands from about 4 o'clock this afternoon.
It sounds like it. Okay, one of those sort of high-end events. Just tell me, you've been obviously talking to people there. Who are some of the most interesting people that you've been able to interview?
Well, I think something that was quite interesting when I was talking to Steve Adell, president of Silversea Luxury Cruise Liner. He was saying that, you know, new destinations are opening up, particularly Myanmar and Burma. So it's a city, you know, that's opening up but doesn't have the infrastructure. So the hotels and things aren't actually there. Now, the advantage of having a cruise liner is that it's a floating hotel, so they can provide that infrastructure at not that much extra cost. But that is definitely one to watch, and hotels will be moving in there in the next couple of years, because the demand is there.
Lovely. And I also gather that you spoke to Paul Jones, the CEO of Lux Resorts.
Yes, now his resorts particularly, he's noticed there's been a big influx of tourism from China who are coming over to the Maldives. It's like, it's one of the biggest destinations for them as a luxury traveller. So that was something quite interesting. The Chinese tourist is an important factor for the travel market. The UK's missed out on the luxury travel from China because of our visa restrictions, but those should lift in the next couple of years so we won't be bypassed. I think another thing that's, I mean, all the luxury hotel brands are moving into China, such as all the Shangri-Las and the major brands, but I think what we might see in the future is a Chinese brand which will set itself up overseas rather than piggybacking on the other brands. An example of this, not necessarily Chinese, but Singaporean Christina Ong has done this with Como Hotels and successfully exported it overseas, for example, with her Hauken Hotel in London.
You were mentioning before about how Burma was a sort of up-and-coming destination. Are there any others that have come across or that any others that can be picked out?
Yeah, definitely. Brazil is another up-and-coming destination. Interesting because it's both for the corporate and the leisure visitor. So for such a big market, it still doesn't have the Mandarin Orientals of this world in it. So that's definitely something that's going to increase. The Brazilian tourist is also on the rise. They're educated travellers that tend to travel with their families. And, for example, hotels like the Bulgari in London, who I was talking to earlier today, were saying that they're catering to these families with, you know, the little details, like things like their suites are connected with twin bedrooms if they were travelling with a family.
And where are tourists coming from? I mean, we're in sort of an age of austerity in Europe. People are tightening their belts all over the world. I mean, is this affecting the sector? And if not, where are the tourists coming from?
I think it's affecting the sector in terms of customers are much more wary of what they're paying for. They're expecting value for money and they're expecting good service. I think the age of the gimmicky kind of pillow menu and bath menu is something that's quite taken a back seat, and the emphasis is back on service. I mean, service should have never been overlooked because it should be an integral part of the hotel kind of package. But, you know, a lot of the big hotel groups are owned by private equity companies, so the personal touch has kind of taken a back seat and the profits are kind of king. So people are re-emphasising service again and that personal touch. I spoke to Silver Sea Cruise President Steve O'Dell and Lux Resort CEO Paul Jones, who told us where to watch out for as the next destinations for travel.
The cruise business overall globally is now around 20 million people a year, and it's divided pretty fairly by markets, America being the biggest. The luxury sector is definitely part of the business that's growing in profile. There is a distinct set of luxury cruise ships that represent the luxury sector of the business, and demand for those is really very high because customers are becoming more discerning. They certainly want the highest level of service, they want suite accommodations, they generally want all-inclusive tariffs, and the luxury sector delivers that very well.
And what defines luxury cruise ships in terms of how it's moving?
Well, the luxury sector tends to be smaller boutique style ships, so generally we'd say under 500 passengers, suite accommodations, and ships that are small enough to get into the more unique ports around the world. For example, we can sail through the River Thames and dock in the middle of London at Tower Bridge. We could sail in through the river into St. Petersburg and dock by the Hermitage. Those are the kind of unique experiences that small ships can bring because we can get up close and personal in destinations.
And what destinations are currently most popular?
Well, I think the hot ticket for next year is going to be in Asia, and I think it's going to be Myanmar. Myanmar's just opening up as a tourist destination, and we see there that there isn't the hotel infrastructure and quality that the luxury customer demands. And so we're going in there a few times with 3-day stops in Yangon, and we see that as an opportunity to bring the luxury cruise product to a new rising destination. The other areas which are opening up are the more expeditionary kind of regions, such as the polar regions, Antarctica, the Arctic. And in 2014, we're actually going to transit the Northwest Passage from the Canadian Arctic to the Pacific. It's the first time we've done it, but people are looking for, luxury customers particularly, are looking for very unique experiences. And so we have to be ahead of the game in finding those unique experiences for the person who wants to travel.
Paul Jones, CEO of Lux Resorts. We're here today at ILTM, and I was just wondering if you could tell us about some trends in the hotel market.
I've been in the resort business for many, many years, particularly in the Indian Ocean. What we're seeing is a trend from the emerging markets such as Russia, China, being very interested in the Indian Ocean. In fact, so interested that China now is the biggest supplier of tourists to the Maldives. It's number one. And recently, we launched direct services from Mauritius to Shanghai in China. So we're also hoping to emulate that success in Mauritius. Of course, there's a reason for that, and that is economics. We've seen the economies in Europe are suffering, and people are obviously diversifying their travel trends to other destinations. So that's obligated us to look further afield to new markets. And I think the other trend that we're seeing, and that's really referring to the European market, is people are looking for value for money. They're looking to see how they can get the most out of their vacation. meaning if there are couples, then they would like to enjoy their time together, not just in the resort, but also outside the resort. So we put together a lot of different opportunities for them to appreciate the nature, the culture, to feel the real heart and soul of the destination.
That was from Monocle contributing editor Alicia Kirby at the International Luxury Travel Market. In a moment, we'll hear about one candidate for the literary hatchet job of the year. But first, some music. Here's I Am What I Am by Marva Whitney and Osaka Monorail. That was I Am What I Am by Marva Whitney and Osaka Monorail. You're listening to Midori House with me, Louise Beale. A well-executed literary hat job can be the stuff of legends. And the novelist Zoe Heller's recent review of Salman Rushdie's fatwa memoir, Joseph Anton, surely falls into this category. Written for the New York Review of Books, she starts off quietly enough by analysing whether fiction can be offensive, before rounding on Rushdie and sticking the boot in. She questions the, and I quote, lordly nonchalance with which Rushdie places himself alongside Lawrence, Joyce and Nabokov in the ranks of literary merit. Hatchet Job of the Year used to just be an honorary title, but now it is a real prize offered by the Omnivore website. Heller is surely going to win this year's title. But someone who can give us more of an idea of whether she's in with a chance joins me now. Welcome Susie Fay, literary critic and blogger, and one of the judges of last year's The Hatchet Job of the Year prize. Susie, it's very nice to see you. Thank you very much for coming in. I mean, first of all, let's discuss this review, Heller's review, that little extract I just read out. I mean, what are your thoughts on it?
I think it's an excellent piece of writing. What we have to remember with reviews is they're not actually written for the author. They're written for the readers of whatever publication that review appears in. So it's a very sophisticated readership who can well decode all the layers in Zoe's absolutely excellent review. And I think she makes some extraordinarily good points. And I think in some cases she's extraordinarily mean. And I've got a bit of a smile on my face as I say that, because somebody described reviewing in England as being a blood sport. And I think there is somewhat of a tradition here.
Yeah. I mean, it is. I mean, some of what she said is pretty harsh. What's the sort of benefit for her? I mean, or is there a danger of criticising someone so harshly, as you say, a bit like a blood sport? Is there a danger for her to ruin her reputation, or do you think it's because it's so well written, it sort of speaks for itself?
Quite the reverse, actually. You don't make your name in this business by being nice. You do make a name by wielding the hatchet. And there have been critics, there are really good critics out there who they're much more known for when they say savage things about a book. And you mentioned the Hatchet Job Prize. In fact, they're going to announce who the judges are this week on Thursday, I think. It's an excellent prize. But I didn't actually agree with the review that won. It's not about, oh, they have to persuade you that what they say is right. They have to write in an entertaining way that makes you think, again, about the book. And Adam Mars-Jones is, I mean, he was such an amazing winner. He's just the perfect hatchet job merchant.
What about for someone, just going back, well, to Heller's review for Rushdie, what for him, is it helpful in a weird kind of way? Because do you think people now want to read it because they want to know why she thought what
exactly
she thought?
I yeah. think so. I mean, I think the very worst sort of review, and I've been told this by people in the industry, is an on the one hand this and on the other hand that sort of review. They don't sell books. Unqualified raves sell books, but actually something that really attacks a writer like this can just pique the interest and make people look at them again. I mean, that book's been out a while here. I think people here who haven't read it, looked at, bought it, would probably think, oh, I fancy that. Yeah. I'm going to go out. So I think it can help a writer.
So do you think perhaps the kind of art of reviewing books is slightly undervalued?
Oh, I definitely think it's undervalued. And in its perverse way, the Hatchett Job Prize is about valuing the art of the critic, the well-written, well-put-together argument. And the people who run the Omnivore website have this idea, which I think is slightly exaggerated myself, that we live in a nicey-nicey, everything's lovely. Oh, I'm best friends with everyone. My best friend's just written a novel. I'm going to commission a great review of it. I think they're a little bit too cynical about reviews, but that's what it's intended to stress, that this is criticism, it's not puffing.
And that's obviously a really good form of journalism, isn't it? Because it's you're being analytical and you're...
It's very skillful. I think it's an undervalued skill, definitely. A review primarily has to be a great piece of writing in itself, and I think Zoe Heller's is. It's not there to sell the product, really. It's there to talk about an art form, to discuss an art form, and I think people slightly lose sight of that.
Now, you were on the panel last year for the Hatchett Job Prize. What's sort of the benefit for whoever wins it? That sounds like a bit of an obvious question, but is it useful? Does it raise their status, or do you hope that perhaps that's something that will gather momentum?
I think it's early days for this prize. It was the first year that it was ever given last year. I think Adam Mars-Jones is very well known as a critic already. And in a sense, it was a little bit of fun. But in a way, what I hope is that it will also enhance the reputation of the person who is game enough, the writer, of the book under review, who can kind of say, yes, I sort of get it. This is a little bit painful, but it's kind of a good thing. I think if writers can be good sports about it, they'll really help themselves. And actually, it's the Bad Sex Prize tonight, and that's known for some writers get terribly offended and upset, and some writers absolutely enter into the spirit and enjoy it. And of course, we all love those people.
Yeah, of course. And what do you think the judges this year will be looking for? I mean, what were you looking for? What kind of criteria did you have set out?
We discussed this at quite some length, and one of the criteria, funnily enough, is it mean? Is it just too mean? I mean, is it gratuitous? We're not about being absolutely horrible. That isn't what the prize is about. It's not about pulling somebody down. It's about a good piece of criticism that will advance the art. So people said that we were bullies, that we were fostering a horrible bullying kind of mentality, and we didn't feel we were doing that at all. It really isn't about being gratuitously mean or too personal.
Because as you say, it's a skill to have if you can review properly. I mean, do you have to check that people who are writing the review don't know the person, they don't have some personal beef with them?
Yes, I was a literary editor for 11 years at The Independent on Sunday, and I must admit I was caught out a couple of times. Funny enough, I was caught out once with somebody reviewing Zoe Heller, who probably shouldn't really have, and I won't go into that anymore. But funnily enough, I mean, you know, Zoe's had savage reviews herself. Yeah. She is in the game.
So, well, there we go. Well, interesting. We will wait with bated breath to see who wins this time. But Susie Fay, literary critic and blogger, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's all, I'm afraid, that we have time for today. Thanks very much to our producer, Aled John, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Sam Impey. Up next after the news is this week's episode of Section D. In 3 hours' time, at 2200 hours London time, Andrew Muller and Tamsin Smith will be back for the Monocle Daily. I will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.